So I wanted to talk for a few minutes today. I actually have a handout which you've seen before, so I'm going to pass that around. I may be one short on the number of copies, I'm not sure. Hi. So I wanted to talk about some stuff that kind of intertwines with or intersects the some of the things that have come up in the talks that Joan gave that we've been listening to recently, as well as our discussions, and then also a couple of things that have come up with different people in work in the room. I'm thinking that this may sort of wander on for two or three sessions. We'll see how it goes. And since we have other great things to do, like the Cohen seminar next week, we'll just sort of weave in and out of it. And you know, I'm not sure, but maybe a couple times in the next month, I'd like to continue along with this. And so, in the broadest terms, I guess I want to explore a kind of very broad, typical Zen narrative that has something to do with things we've talked about a lot, like going into the dark and coming back up into the light, or what's called in the trade rolling in and rolling out. And throughout what I'm going to talk about, there are a couple of kind of open source animating concerns or threads that may be more obvious toward the end than toward the beginning. But one is that sort of wonderfully manic penchant for inclusivity. So always with Joan, it's not this or that, but it's this and that, making room for both things or both halves of a dyad. And so despite the fact that Zen practice is often very strict and very spare or sparse, it seems to me we have a sort of wonderful tolerance and even enthusiasm for human messiness. So I certainly don't want to end up in some place that would not leave room for that. And then more specifically, and I think this came up in the talk that we listened to last week, Joan from time to time comes back to that notion of the awakened life or the open source interest in reclaiming the self. And so that's certainly part of where this will end up. So, you know, one of the things we're certainly not trying to do in our practice is get rid of individuality or idiosyncrasy. And we're not certainly trying to eliminate or squeeze ourselves down to the bare nub or to emerge from Zen practice with a kind of improved vanilla self. One of the things that both Joan and John talk about sometimes is that there's a certain amount of sort of cultural translation difficulty with this notion of self or no self. I remember John saying specifically that one of the things that meant in Buddhism was that there was no eternal, sort of essential and unchanging self, just like in that sense there's no tree and there's no car either. So he said not to have a self in that sense doesn't mean not to have a self in some other senses that we're more used to in an everyday way of talking. And he said it certainly doesn't mean to not have a personality, and went on to note that if you try to have no personality, really to be completely vanilla, you haven't gotten rid of a self, but you've turned yourself into a zombie self. So we're not interested in Zen zombie selves, at least within in our group as I understand it. So as a kind of trailer, I want to go back to the Cohen seminar from about 3 weeks ago and talk about that for a second, and then we'll sort of dive someplace else, but we'll sort of work our way back around to these issues one or two talks from now. So what I remember when we talked about this, and Roberto said he might be here today, I'm sorry that he isn't because he had one of the really strong reactions, is that of these two Cohens from September 2nd, people seemed a lot more initially comfortable and enthusiastic about one and not so comfortable about the other in a way that I think is pretty typical. And I remember something similar happening with a similar pair of Cohens over in Santa Fe one time. So remember, one of the Cohens is, a monk asked Dongshan, when the heat and cold come, how can we avoid them? Dongshan said, why don't you go to the place where there's no cold or heat? The monk said, what is the place where there's no cold or heat? Thinking he's going to get out of the problem. And Dongshan said, when it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. And that's the Cohen that most of us were more initially comfortable with. It feels like the idea that we have about Zen, I think. So in this Cohen, in some sense, there's no self here that's not completely permeated or flowed through by what's around that self. So one avoids, quote unquote, the heat and cold by just becoming completely hot, completely cold, not setting up any boundaries at all. If you go over to the other side of the page, there's that quotation from Keats, just the middle of the page. As to the poetical character itself, it is not itself. I'll skip over the Wordsworth thing. It has no self. It is everything and nothing. It has no character. A poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually in for and filling some other body. And then right up above, or if a sparrow come before my window, I take part in its existence and pick about the gravel. So that sense of really just being sort of washed over and really being, I don't even know the right word, just sort of a litmus paper for whatever passes through is certainly an important part of practice, and one I think that many of us come to practice expecting to have fulfilled by our work in Zen. Back to the other side of the page, the other thing that we looked at, which is not a koan, but is a very famous myth and turns up as a commentary in a couple of koans, seemed to make people a little more uneasy. On being born, it is said, the Buddha took 7 steps in each of the 4 cardinal directions, pointed with one hand up and one hand down, and said, above the heavens, below the earth, I alone am the world honored one. And then if we go back over to the other side of the page, this is from Robert Aiken's commentary, and it's talking about a different case in the Gateless Barrier. A monk asked Baizhang, what is the matter of special wonder? Baizhang said, sitting alone, Tasing Peak. Tasing Peak is also called Mount Baizhang. Yasutani Roshi comments on this dialogue, the universe has entered his belly in this sitting alone. He lies down alone on Tasing Peak. He walks alone on Tasing Peak. Wherever no one accompanies him, he goes out alone, he returns alone, he is all alone. This is not the 4 cardinal half points above, below, north, south, east, west, sort of all directions, everything interpenetrated and interpermeated. It is instead above the heavens, below the heavens, only I, the world honored one. And then Aiken goes on to say, this sitting alone is not everywhere, Yasutani Roshi is saying. It is not the dimension of pervading the whole universe. It is not the interdependence of all things. Rather, it is the fact expressed mythically by the infant Buddha when he pointed above and below and said that he was the only one anywhere, alone and revered, and that he was altogether at ease about it. I remember being really scandalized some years ago by a sort of similar sense of what enlightenment or awakening or one aspect of it might be like. There was a discussion list in the open source a long time ago, and I remember at some point somebody quoted the end of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. It's not the very end, but the beginning of the last section, which goes, the spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I too am not a bit tamed. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world, which is just great, you know. But so I always loved that. But people got on the list and said, oh, so that's awakening, that's enlightenment, this sense of being sort of completely full of, you know, I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. And it really startled me because I'm a Whitman scholar, you know, so I spent about 10 years writing a book on Whitman, and I love Whitman, but this always seemed to me to be the part of Whitman or the aspect of Whitman that was completely non-Buddhist. You know, if it's so much about yourself, how could you say that, you know? So I got on the list and sort of said all those things. And Mary Montoya, who you may remember from Colorado, who used to sit with us in Santa Fe, got on the list and said some very nice things. And one thing she said was that she said she likes to think that both the hawk and Whitman were enlightened in this moment, you know, and she really insisted that this too was something really central about the sort of transformation that can happen to us through practice or in Zen. And I remember thinking at the time, being really startled by that and thinking that it still felt wrong to me and I didn't get it and it was really troubling. But there was something about the way she said it that made me think I want to hold open a place for that to be part of what practice is also about. And way at the end of, you know, whenever we get around to this in a couple of weeks, I'll tell a story about my chihuahua that's sort of the fulfillment of the spotted hawk. You know? So the chihuahua turns out to be above the heavens, below the earth, only I am the world honored one. You know? But at any rate, you know, my sense is that for a lot of us, this sense that that would be part of Zen, that the barbaric yawp, which has some relation to the teisho, the big shout, that initially that seems like not what we're here for, and we're here to get out of that, or it feels wrong. And so where I want to end up at some point is to say, you know, really those two moments, the moment of just being completely permeated by everything, everything's interpermeated, and that really sort of opposite sort of feel of moment of just, you know, wham, here's Tenny, you know, Tathagata, that both those things are part of, in an important way, what can happen and what can shift through practice, you know, the embrace of both of those things. So that's where we're headed. We don't have time to do very much more, but I just want to point toward the big detour that I want to take, you know, which will be maybe next time. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to work my way back around to those two really different senses of personhood through exploring a kind of canonical Zen narrative of what happens in practice and how practice unfolds. Mary, I wish Mary were here. Mary likes to stress often that everybody's experience with practice is different. And I think that's really true. For me, the other side of it is that there are a lot of shared experiences that people who practice for a long time tend eventually to bump into, and they tend to be fairly important. Everybody's got their own version of them in some way, but it seems to me useful to think about a sort of narrative of maybe one sort of archetypal trajectory of what can happen in practice. So I want to get there, and again, we won't go very far today, but if you've sat retreats with us, probably if you've sat retreats with anybody, one of the canonical afternoon readings is Shito Shishen taking part in the gathering. If you study in a more Japanophilic group, Shito will be called Sekito, and taking part in the gathering will be called the Sandokai. And those of you who know Suzuki Roshi pretty well know that he gave a series of lectures on the Sandokai. It's called Branching Streams, Flow in the Darkness, Zen Talks on the Sandokai. And that's been turned into a book, which I've been rereading a little bit the last 2 weeks. So again, down the road, we'll work our way back around to some of what Suzuki Roshi has to say. For those of you who don't know, and probably most of you do, but Shito Shichen is like an 8th century Chan teacher in China, and he and Great Master Ma are really the two great defining teachers of that period. They're both two teaching generations down from Wei Nung, the beginning of the Southern School. And the way the story unfolds, they're both Southern versus the Northern School, and I'll say something about that in a second. But within the Southern School, Shito in some way is going to lead toward what becomes Soto Zen, and Great Master Ma is going to lead to Linchi and Rinzai Zen, which is the Japanese name for Linji. And in some way, the way people think about it is that within the Southern School, Soto and Shito are the more Northern version. Norman talks about this way, of the Southern School, whereas Great Master Ma and Linchi are the more Southern of the Southern School. So that already tells you that Shito in some way is sort of, it's wrong to call him a fence straddler, but he's occupying this position of both and rather than neither nor. And in fact, that's how the poem begins. It's not crucial for where I want to head, but I think I'll end by just talking about that aspect of it in a second and then reading you the important part, which we'll get back to in a couple of weeks. I'm sorry, this is, you know, obviously there's way more here than we can do in one time. So in our translation, in Joan and John's translation, it begins, "The mind of the great Indian immortal moves seamlessly between East and West. It's human nature to be quick or slow, but in the way there are no Northern or Southern ancestors." So one of the things that Joan has stressed is that this notion of the mind of the great Indian immortal moving seamlessly is an idealization in both sometimes a troubling way and sometimes an inspiring way. I think the importance of Shito stressing it at the opening is in light of what comes up in the next two lines. That is, there may be a Northern and a Southern school, but in the way, fundamentally, there are no Northern or Southern ancestors. There's one tradition, there are versions of how to practice it, there are various tactics, but there aren't fundamentally two notions of what the way is or what Zen is. And in a similar way, you may be quick or you may be slow, and if you tend to be a quick kind of guy, you may be drawn to the Southern school, and if you're sort of a gradual guy, you may be drawn to the Northern school, but finally it doesn't matter. They're all versions of practice unfolding. And so to go back to my little staging of what Mary likes to say, in some sense each practice is individual, and in some sense there's something archetypal that can happen in practice that isn't fundamentally sort of thrown off course by whether you're Soto or Rinzai or Northern or Southern. Just to give you a little bit about that divide anyway. So the Northern school begins with a poem by Xin Shui. So Hangren, who's the fifth ancestor, says, I'm going to pass the transmission to somebody, I'm going to give my dharma to somebody, and whoever can write the best enlightenment poem is the guy who gets it. And Xin Shui, who's the head monk and very educated, writes, all the translations of this are terrible, and this is sort of badly rhymed, but I think it's clear anyway. The body is the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. The mind is standing mirror bright. At all times polish it diligently and let no dust alight. It's not great poetry, you know, as translated, but that's that sense of you need to constantly polish, you need constantly to get rid of distractions, and there's a sense of a gradual sort of clearing of things away. And Wei Nung, who supposedly, at least the myth is, was an illiterate peasant and had to get somebody to write his poem on the wall for him, writes instead, the Bodhi is no tree, nor a standing mirror bright, since all is originally empty, where can any dust alight? And that's, again, a really bad rhyme version of it. But I think the idea is, you know, sort of fundamentally, no mind, no mirror, everything is empty, no need to wipe it away. And the idea would be that you can have a deep realization of that in a moment, and that in a way, you know, you can get rid of your polishing rags or something like that, you know. I guess what I want to stress is that Northern or Southern, quick or slow individually, that the way is still the way, and you get there when you get there. And since we're about out of time, I'm going to close with one koan that John presents in a certain circumstance, which we've done at retreats, and which is very beautiful and speaks to some of this. So the teacher said to the gathering, if you get it the first time you hear it, you will teach the Buddhas and ancestors. If you get it the second time you hear it, you will teach gods and humans. That's like community college or something. If you don't get it till the third time you hear it, you won't even be able to save yourself. A student asked, when did you get it? The teacher said, the moon sets at midnight. I walk alone through the town. It doesn't matter when you get it. It doesn't matter, you know, that just there it is. I'm just going to quote to you, and then I'll be done, the next lines in the Shitto, which actually begin to head into this sort of mythic narrative of practice. And the one thing I will say, and then we'll get back to this in a couple weeks, is it seems to me that one of the things that's interesting about this passage from taking part in the gathering is that partly it presents a kind of cosmic mythology, which is based on Taoism as the understanding. So here's the sort of origin story. But at the same time, it seems to be a sort of guide to what can unfold in practice. So it's simultaneously, here's the way the universe got going, and oh, if this is a nice story about how the universe got going, certain things follow about what practice might look like and how it might develop. So let me just read that, and then we'll get back to it in a couple weeks. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. Trying to control things is only delusion, but hanging on to the absolute isn't enlightenment either. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, and this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. And then skipping just a few lines, the darkness is inside the bright, but don't look only with the eyes of the dark. The brightness is inside the dark, but don't look only with the eyes of the bright. Bright and dark are a pair, like front foot and back foot walking. So where I want to head is partly thinking about going into the dark and in practice and what the relation is between dark and light. And then once we get back to the light, I'm most interested in, and this is really to go back to the two koans we started with, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, and this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So that doesn't settle on one side or the other. And I think I'll stop there for now.
Thank you.
If we have a minute or two, if anybody wants to say anything.
What's that last poem, Tony?
That's still part of taking part in the gathering from the sutra service. You know? Yeah.
Shitto?
That's Shitto, okay. Yeah.
So what about the not interweaving?
Well, yeah. So what about the Chihuahua? Right. You know, what about only I am the world honored one? That's what I'm trying to suggest, okay. It's not just Aiken saying something or somebody on a list in open source. This very, very canonical Zen text really stresses both those sides. And if we spend enough time to really do this, I'll quote some stuff from Suzuki Roshi's book on it, where he does just the same thing. There's a little plant on it in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, where he says, and again, it's very strong, he says, you're the boss. When the boss sleeps, everybody sleeps. You say, that's not Zen, you know, but, well, yeah, it is, you know, but, so that's, you know, so there's something that's like a head scratcher here. That's the same thing that was a head scratcher with the Buddha saying, above the heavens and below the earth, only I am the world honored one. So. And the point would be, you know, you're not going to have to choose, right? So.
Is that true traditionally as well?
What?
Like Joan stresses that the inclusiveness and the...
This is like an 8th century Chan text by one of the two central 8th century teachers who's understood to be sort of the granddaddy before the letter of Soto Zen.
So her stressing of that is just making that point?
Yeah. I don't know very much about it in some way. I'm just sitting here in Tucson also.
Structured traditional practice. And my perception is some people are either Soto school or they're Rensai.
Yeah.
And there's like either or. I
think that's true in a way, but I think the American teachers, Suzuki was really good friends with Soen Roshi, who's a great Rensai teacher. We're part of the Sambo Kyoto, which is exactly a third stream, which was started by Soto guys who said, you know, Soto practice has got to be revitalized, so we're going to reintroduce Rinzai Koan work to Soto Zen. So the Sambo Kyodan, out of which the Diamond Sangha grows, out of which we come, is completely a fusion school. But I guess what I would want to stress is I think that there's always that tendency, the danger in a way of the sort of rigorous aspect of practice, you know, it's so hard and you have to do this and it's so stylized, is that it's going to tend to make that sort of cutting gesture and say this goes out and this comes in. But that's always a mistake and a misunderstanding, that there's something crucial in the tradition that's always said sort of both and if you think it's either or, you miss something. You know? I think within an American context, and again, I haven't practiced that many places, but I think John and Joan are unusually and scandalously insistent on bringing everything in, you know. But I think that's a fundamental impulse within Chan and Zen Buddhism. So it's not just Americans got a hold of it and went nuts. I guess anything else, I think we're kind of out of time.
Speaking of American Buddhism, is that true of all Western Buddhism?
I don't know. My sense is that it is, but I'm not sure. Because partly I read people who would tend to say, oh, yeah, that's true. Do you know what I mean?
That would be the
Yeah. All right, thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.